Which brings me to a chat I had with particle physicist Albert Dirac from the CMS experiment. We talked about what the Higgs discovery means for alternative models of physics, such as supersymmetry, and the hunt for extra dimensions. And we also talked about what it felt like to be at the LHC in the run-up to the announcement. Speaking to me from Ghana, Dirac began by telling me about CERN's efforts to cash in on the global excitement surrounding the Higgs. He was out there encouraging students in Africa to take up science, engineering, and, of course, particle physics.
So, and it's exciting, you're talking from Ghana. What are you doing in Ghana?
Well, this is a school for physics, actually. It's an initiative with some of us had to bring also physics knowledge. And this whole adventure that we are having right now with the physics we study at the LHC, also to this continent.
Is the idea to bring particle physics to school children or college students?
It's more like to the universities, to students at the universities, and maybe for some of them, but I think particle physics by itself isn't, as I see it, an excellent training ground for even more global or more general type of interest further on. It could be in engineering, it could be in microelectronics and computing. And I would imagine that many of the people which would be eventually interested in that here would not necessarily just follow the road of particle physics, but would look at it as a launching pad also to get into contact with newest technologies and newest developments. So I see it more as a catalyzer. Now, everywhere in the world there are brilliant minds around which just must be given the right opportunities to develop, and I think we will also discover good African physicists which will play a role in particle physics because they're interested in that, and with that kind of connection may well hook on to, for example, the CERN program, and by visiting us first and then, you know, starting something in the country they're coming from and be a part of this science adventure as well.
Of course, you know, the Higgs discovery was just met with so much excitement around the world. Were you surprised by that, or were you expecting that level of excitement?
I was expecting a great deal of excitement by the science community. I was completely baffled by the media and general public interest in this phenomenon, and it looked like everybody, you know, wanted to be part of it. And I have myself seen the discovery from down under, that is from Australia, where we had this big conference, which happened actually at that time, and for which essentially we were sort of getting the results together to be able to present them. And it was absolutely amazing, like, you know, the whole of Australia was sort of on top of this, and we were asked to, you know, give interviews on television and things like that, mostly trying to explain what it actually is that we have discovered.
Well, so then I should ask you, what is it that you've actually discovered? We hear about the Higgs field, we hear about the Higgs boson, we've been told that they give the particles mass. Do you have an explanation for how that all comes about?
Well, in the simplest way, I would put it as the following. It gives us finally a clue why we are here, in the sense how it is possible that out of a hot soup at the time of the Big Bang, actually something crystallized as atoms and matter and so on that would come out of it. For that was not sort of like evidence that would happen. In the very beginning of the universe, energies were very high, particles were effectively massless, and they were zapping around with the speed of light. If the universe would have continued that way, there's no way that matter could be found with particles just zapping around with the speed of light. So at some point, some phase transition happened where this, what we think and believe now is the Higgs field, that indeed provoked that, and that gave resistance to particles. It slowed them down. It gave them mass. Mass is resistance to the velocity which you have. And because of that, atoms could be formed, and we could be here. Now, de facto, of course, we know we are here, so something had to happen. But now, by discovering this mechanism, we actually start to understand how we came about. as a scientist myself, I look to the Higgs even as something much more important. That is, you know, the Higgs could tell us and could hint us what is actually happening between the large scale when the Higgs field came into creation and where we are now, and what kind of new physics is lying on that path, and, you know, give us a clue to this kind of new physics, maybe indicate directly what the new physics is, which we're going to see, which we have to understand for still trying to see how the whole world came about.
So we all listened to this announcement from the outside, but what was happening in the run-up to the announcement at CERN? Can you tell us about how, you know, at what point you realized that you were able to go forward and make a big announcement? And how long did you have to sort of keep that quiet? And how was it difficult to keep that quiet?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an interesting scientific as well as sociologic question, I would say, because, you know, these collaborations that I'm working in, there are two big experiments, each of them having more than 3,000 people in the experiment, scientists, of course, eager, you know, to discuss what they were seeing, but against strict rules, because I think we found it very important that the two experiments did not know from each other what they were seeing, so that, you know, you could genuinely work on your own data, come to your own conclusions, and then you confront it in a public meeting with what the other experiment is seeing. So there was, of course, the odd chance that, for example, one experiment is seeing a clear signal, the other experiment is not seeing a clear signal, then it's often an ambiguous situation. Now, that did not happen in this case. The two experiments saw a very clear situation, a very clear signal in the same direction, so that was a good thing. Now, the run-up for that was very interesting indeed. So what happened is, historically, that around about December last year, we analyzed all the data which we collected in 2011. When we looked at the data, both experiments saw a glimpse of sort of popping up of the Higgs signal in the data. It was not enough in any way to make a firm conclusion, but it was something hopeful, something saying, yeah, something is probably growing there. It could still go away. It could be still called, you know, what they call it, statistical fluctuation. But, you know, there was something sitting at a particular mass in the both experiments. So that was very interesting. So what we decided in the CMS experiment then at that point was, good, let's, you know, accumulate as much data as we can for this checkpoint, which was the conference which happened in Australia. And let's not look at the data. Let's do the analysis, what you call in a blinded way. So you look at everything around the signal, but not at the signal itself. You do not want to optimize the analysis for making that signal grow. You want to let it grow by itself without looking at it. And so we did that. And so we had the checkpoint, which was like 2.5 weeks before that conference started, that we, what we call, opened the box. We unveiled what was really sitting in there. And this was a very, very dramatic meeting which we had in our collaboration. This was a room where, I mean, I would say that there were twice as many people in there as there were seats. There were lots of people, hundreds, on video conferencing following that. We did all measures to make it not possible to disperse this information afterwards. And then we looked at the results. And at that point, and I still remember that, that was on the 15th of June, around 3 o'clock, I knew we had a discovery. In fact, the 600-700 people following that at the same time with us knew at this point we had a discovery. And of course, then we had to sit on it for 2 weeks, not talk about it, make sure nothing leaks out at any other side. I'm sure the other experiment was in a similar situation. I mean, seeing it now, what they had. And these were very, you know, very tense days, let's say.
You know, on the day, who decided who made the announcement first, CMS or ATLAS? Because, you know, they're two groups, they're two experiments, and one of them, you know, one of you has to go forward and present first. So how was that decided?
So, in fact, the December meeting, ATLAS, the other experiment, was given the choice to give the talk first or second. And then they decided to go first, or they gave the talk first in December. This time around, our experiment was asked, CMS, whether they would like to give the talk first or second. by management of CERN. And CMS decided to give the talk first. And next time we have something on any other important announcement of that sort, it will be again Atlas where the first choice.
Right, I see. And now let's talk about the actual result itself. You know, there's a lot of excitement over what the mass of the Higgs would be. And why couldn't theoretical physicists predict one single value for the mass of the Higgs and just tell everybody, go and look there? Why was there some ambiguity?
Because that is actually, in the theory, there is nothing that constrains that mass to be at a certain value. In fact, it's not quite true. We know through what we call quantum corrections that other measurements which we are making, precision measurements which we've been making at the different colliders, actually do give us information where the mass could be experimentally. But that is a very, very broad region where that could happen. But the theory itself doesn't predict that. Once you have that mass, you can predict all the other properties of the Higgs, or standard model Higgs, as we call it. And so now that we have the mass within a GeV or 2 GeV or so, we can predict all couplings it may have to other kinds of particles. The mass is extremely important because the mass really determines, for example, viability of certain theories. Supersymmetry does not like, for example, such a mass in that high corner. They would have preferred like 115 to 120 rather than 125.
So one question that's come in related to that from quite a few of the readers of the site and the listeners on the podcast is that if you didn't know what the mass of the Higgs should have been, how do you know that you have found the Higgs and not some other particle, some kind of imposter?
Yes, right. So if you read carefully what we are saying and writing, I mean, I oversimplified in the podcast a bit, but we are saying we found a Higgs-like particle.
Mm.
We know pretty much it's a boson because of the particles it decays in. It decays, for example, in 2 photons, 2 Zs, and so forth. That's what you could expect a boson to be doing. We know that since it decays into 2 photons, that it's not a vector type of particle. So it's most likely a scalar type of particle. And a scalar type of particle, a fundamental scalar, we haven't actually seen yet, ever. This is the first ever fundamental scalar we see in nature. And that makes it very exciting. And that's exactly what the Higgs should be. But we call it Higgs-like because, yes, we want to stay a little careful. Of course, it seems to walk like a Higgs. It seems to talk like a Higgs if you look at the properties. But we still have to really actually pin it down. Is it, first of all, a Higgs, and even more if it is D Higgs? In D Higgs, I mean the particle which Peter Higgs had in mind when he wrote theories which were connected to what we call now the standard model, and that would be the standard model Higgs in that sense. This we can't claim today yet. What we can see is that what we see is very consistent with such a standard model Higgs. If you look at the ratios, how often it decays into 2 photons, how often it decays in other particles, it looks sort of about right. But these are very, very crude measurements right now.
And so when you're talking about pinning down its properties, what sort of things will you now be trying to look at?
Mm-hmm. Well, most important are going to be its quantum numbers. So what the state of that particle is. And technically that's called, it is the scalar indeed, or is it a pseudoscalar, or something else, which we don't believe, but among the first which I mentioned, this is still open. And we look at that by really looking at many of these decays of these particles, and we need more of the decays than what we have so far, and looking in what they call angular distributions. So we're going to be able to say something on these quantum numbers, technically also called the spin of that particle, or the spin parity of that particle. The other thing we're going to be looking for, or measuring, actually, is how often does that particle decay in other different particle species? For example, how often does it decay in 2 photons? How often does it decay in 2 B quarks? And compare that with, as I said, everything we can now calculate because we have the mass. So we can predict exactly in the standard model and in other models what the, for example, the ratio of these two decay modes should be. And so, but for that, again, now we just observe it. So this doesn't give us by any means enough collisions or statistics to actually do these measurements. But we are collecting more collisions during this year, up to the end of the year, and maybe we will triple our total amount of Higgs particles, if you want. And that should already start to give us some insight in that.
And so you started to talk about some of the different models, the standard model. You're talking about supersymmetry. Can you just expand a little bit more on what supersymmetry is and why people are looking for evidence for it and what exactly this result means for that theory?
Mm-hmm. So supersymmetry is an idea that's propagated quite a while back, over 20 years ago, that nature may have another symmetry, which we haven't seen evidence for, but maybe there, to help us understanding why the universe is so stable the way it is, in a way. And that predicts that for each particle that we know now, each elementary particle, quarks, leptons, or the bosons which we are having as elementary particles, that there are partners, so-called super partners, which are generally much more heavy than the original particles because we haven't seen them yet, and which have a different quantum numbers, so that, in fact, by the existence of these particles, we can stabilize a lot of things in the theory. So it's enormously attractive from that point of view that that could be something that would happen in nature. And then, for example, also string theories typically need supersymmetry in there to make it work. So there's, from that point in the theoretical community, a lot of belief that this could be the right path. But of course, it's not the only thing people are working on. From the practical side, if indeed supersymmetry would exist, that could help us to explain dark matter, for example, which is one of the mysteries still around us, that we know that most of the matter around which we see gravitationally in the universe seems to be of a different kind than the one we, you know, from our daily life. Now, as for the Higgs, that has a lot to tell on this supersymmetry. For example, the Higgs mass of 125 GeV is a little uncomfortable for supersymmetry. It's on the high side. It's still possible for supersymmetry to encompass that, but it squeezes out a lot of the possible phase space of where these models could live for what's really going on. So in that sense, the Higgs will first of all reduce largely the amount of supersymmetry space that could possibly be there, and we wouldn't know where to look exactly, so it can give us directions where to look. And the Higgs itself, as a particle, in a supersymmetric environment, will not be exactly the same as a standard model Higgs. And measuring deviations or differences with what we expect a standard model Higgs to be in the properties can tell us also directly what kind of supersymmetry we're dealing with, and if supersymmetry exists altogether.
And has the finding already helped you rule out any other models? I've been reading about Technicolor.
Well, there are models that don't have a Higgs, or don't want a Higgs, or don't need a Higgs. And so particularly in Technicolor, Higgs has no particular role whatsoever. They have a different type of mechanism that does what in the standard model Higgs is doing. So finding a Higgs is, of course, a killing stroke to the so-called Higgsless models, models that, you know, said that Higgs doesn't exist and we do it in a different way. Well, apparently, it doesn't look like it. Of course, we have to remember that we still at this moment talk about a Higgs-like particle, which we have found, so we have to be a little careful and not jump too much. But it's certain that the bets on these models, the so-called Higgsless models, have gone down quite a bit in the last week.
You know, you mentioned that supersymmetry would have preferred a Higgs that was a bit lighter, so somewhere between about 115 and 120. As you were going through the data, and I know it takes a very long time to analyze all the data and really see what you're seeing, really understand it, when you didn't see a signal at that mass, did you get worried? I mean, was there a genuine worry that maybe you were never going to see anything?
Okay, so as it was, we started to have really competitive Higgs analysis starting from last summer, exactly a year ago or so. And then we saw two things, and that tells you that one cannot jump to conclusions too fast, that there was some kind of accumulation starting to happen around the higher mass, 140 GeV. But that went away, and that was typically a statistical fluctuation which went away. It was not very significant, but you know, when you see things for the first time, people jump at that. And as we were looking further on in the data in the summer, there wasn't any clear signature where something was going to happen, and we were excluding bigger and bigger regions. Always the low mass region we couldn't exclude yet because our sensitivity wasn't good enough, which means we hadn't have enough data for that yet. But at that time, yes, there started to be the idea, maybe, you know, by the end of the year, meaning this year, then we rule out that whole region and we don't see particular new particles. So what then? We have to go maybe to the blackboard and redesign, or we really have to take all this Higgs-less type of theories much more seriously, and maybe we have to, you know, change the rifle from shoulder and attack it in a different way. That certainly was, I think, fall last year was the period where we thought we could be ending up in that kind of situation. And but then we looked at the totality of the data collected last year, and as I said, in December, we saw there was one region which we're not going to be able to exclude that easily because it was resisting to be excluded. And, you know, that finally was the region where we found the particles.
And what about some of the other things that we've been very excited about possibly finding at the LHC? So things like extra dimensions, things like mini black holes. You know, does this result have any implications for how likely we are to find these things, or is it completely unrelated?
The extra dimension models are still particularly viable. Again, there are also extra dimension models which were speculating that you know, the mass generation mechanism came in a different way than by the Higgs. Well, these, of course, are not so favorable at the moment anymore. But most of these models do need a Higgs of some sort to do that part of the job.
You've outlined, you know, a number of things that you're going to be looking for now.
Mm-hmm.
What's going to be the sort of the time frame, you know, until the next big announcement, do you think?
I wish I knew. I think we know now, first of all, the other things which you mentioned, we are looking for those already. And in parallel, you know, we are 3,000 people. I said 700 work on the Higgs. Well, there's still over 1,000 working on other subjects, like supersymmetry searches, like extra dimension searches, like even alternative type of new physics model searches. And they will be ongoing. Now, the accelerator runs till the end of the year. We collect data. And then we have a data sample, very good for studying the Higgs particle, and as much as we can go for studying other new effects which are all on our checklist. Whether we will see something there or not, you know, nature knows, I don't know. We will see if any day with what we are doing, we are pushing further in new regimes. You know, we boldly go where no man has gone before, essentially. So any day something can happen, something can drop out, and that, of course, will be then the next big thing to talk about. What I can say is I think that by the end of the year, beginning next year, we're going to have the sum up of our understandings then of that Higgs particle. So it may well be that the next big announcement is going to come from there, saying that, you know, maybe we found that it's not the Higgs particle, but a Higgs particle with different properties. That would be a big thing too.
Before I let you go, it's been about 3 weeks now, a little bit over, since the announcement. Do you have any funny stories about the reactions to that announcement?
The most amazing story I had was when I was sitting, of all places, a week, I think, after the event in the airport of Hong Kong. I was just sitting in the, you know, waiting with a drink in the bar, waiting for my plane to take off. And there was a guy coming up to me. And I said, I've seen you in the newspaper. And I said, really, yes. And then he said, yeah, and I had to get a screensaver now for his computer. So he opened his computer, and the screensaver was a picture which actually was published in the Times, London Times, where the day after they showed a picture from Melbourne, and in the front row, three or four people you saw very enthusiastically cheering while it was announced that it was called a discovery officially. And I was one of these four people. And since he was looking at the screen on a daily basis since a week, he liked that picture so much that he quit the green screen. He immediately, without any doubt, recognized me in the airport of Hong Kong. It was a guy from New Zealand. I mean, I don't know who. And so I have found it pretty amazing that, we have our 15 minutes of glory, let's say, through this. And some people in the street, if you want, will go to an airport at that point. Just recognize you and say, hey, I saw you.
Well, congratulations on the result and congratulations on being famous now and someone who's recognized on the street.
Thank you to Albert de Roerck there for keeping us up to date with the Higgs search.